Okay. We'll call the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division together for Wednesday, February 25th. We have four bills on the agenda. Thanks for joining us, Senator Sharon. We'll start with you. Senate File 410.
Senate File 410. Thank you. Let me make sure I've got the right bill in front of me.
Advanced Care Planning Grant. Looks like a first engrossment. So you've been someplace else with this.
Okay, thank you very much. Yes, we have. Senator Lurie and members, there are two bills in front of you, 410 and 407, and they both have a common theme to them, which is about encouraging people to talk now, not later, about how they want to live their life. And oftentimes we'll have a lot of conversations too late about important factors as it relates to living. And what this initiative does is encourage through some grants, especially on 410, which is the Advanced Care Planning Grant Program, to provide some resources to local communities to develop projects that fit within their communities, by those communities, to begin a process of having early conversations and discussions about how people want to live the last couple of quarters of their life. So what this bill does is require the Commissioner of Health to award grants to nonprofit organizations and local public health boards to develop and implement comprehensive initiatives targeted to a designated community to encourage advanced care planning discussions among individuals and their families, their caregivers, their health care providers, their faith community. It also states the purposes of the grant, which are to increase social awareness of the need for this kind of conversation within a community, to encourage and assist individuals, families, and caregivers, and healthcare providers to begin having and continue over and over to have conversations about the decisions and the choices people want to make about how they want to live the last quarters of their life, and to promote the availability and increase awareness of the resources that are available. The grants are to be distributed based on best practices, on public health research and principles, since this really is a public health initiative, and on community input, on the community's needs and values, and to address health disparities and cultural differences that may exist in the community to be served. Paragraph D requires the application be submitted by September 1st of each year. It specifies that it must describe the proposed initiative, the proposed outcomes in the evaluation process to be used, and identify the technical assistance and oversight needs that may be needed to develop the strategies. This section about the technical assistance oversight needs that they may need relates to a 10% request for technical assistance that you will read later in the grant. And also very much relates to the other bill that we're talking about, which is 407. Paragraph F requires each recipient to report to the Commissioner of Health on the progress of the initiative at least once during the grant period and to submit a final report, and requires the Commissioner to award the grant to a statewide advanced care planning resource organization that has the expertise in this community-based advanced care planning activity and initiative, and to provide the assistance referred to under paragraph D, technical assistance and oversight. There's a commissioner report to the legislature by February 15th on this advanced care planning grant program. Subdivision 5 specifies that there's nothing in this bill that is to be construed or to condone or authorize or approve any kind of mercy killing, euthanasia, or assisted suicide. And Section 3 appropriates the money to the Commissioner of Health. That's in essence what this bill is focused on and what we're attempting to accomplish. I do have a A2 amendment.
Okay. Let's pass out the A2 amendment.
Thank you.
Senator Lori, I have an oral amendment to the A2 amendment. Should I make that now before we proceed with the amendment? On line 1.5, I'd like you to delete after insert 5, the number 5, and put the number 10 for 10% rather than 5%.
Okay.
And with that oral amendment, I'd like to move the A2 amendment.
Any questions on the A2 amendment? So what this is doing is filling in the dot, dot, dots for what the appropriation is. You had reined it in to 5%, but
yes,
just decided to stay with the 10. Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, okay, is 10% a standard of some sort that we give commissioners for technical assistance and oversight? Because it was 5, you had a reason for choosing that number, and now it's up to 10. And I don't remember, I know we've had these conversations before, but we usually allow some amount of administrative cost, and I just want to make sure we're staying in line.
This is for the technical assistance and oversight grant, so it's somebody else providing technical assistance, is that right? And as I
yes.
read the fiscal note, there's additional overhead administrative costs at the Department of Human Service, or at the Department of Health, rather, to administer this of approximately $225,000 or so.
I see it, Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon. Right, the 10% is in the fiscal note.
All yes, right. It is. It's just, it was an error in my amendment. So that, and the 10% is not for the department. It's for this organization that has to purchase the rights to materials that are used to help develop competencies and capacities for trainers, for example, and they have scientifically based information that they utilize. They have to pay a fee for that, and they have to utilize their staff in the organization to go out to these communities and facilitate in the community. So that's what that 10% is for.
Any other questions on the A2 amendment? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves the A2 amendment as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. Okay.
Senator Lori, if
Senator
you...
Sharon.
I know this is a little unusual, but may I speak to the second bill at the same time? And then you can have one set of testifiers on the whole
sure.
deal. Okay, great. The second bill is... an appropriation to...
No, let's lay Senate File 410 on the table and take up Senate File 407, just for, so we're clear on the record. So, Senator Sharon on Senate File 407.
Thank you. I have an A1 amendment to Senate File 407.
Senator Sharon moves the A1 amendment. Let's have that passed out. This is, again, filling in that appropriation, correct?
This is correct. This is filling in the blank spaces for the appropriations upon which the fiscal note has been developed.
And this is your first stop, so this would be an author's amendment, so we don't need discussion on it. All those in favor of the A for 40? Yeah, for this one it is. Did she? 410. Right here, it says that it was withdrawn.
This was heard in Health and Human Services also, Senator Lori, so this is the bill that...
says that it wasn't, but okay.
It says withdrawn and re-referred.
As introduced, and it says that it was withdrawn from Health and Human Services, but it's fine. We can discuss the A1 amendment. It's inserting an appropriation. I thought I was being helpful.
Thank you. Thank you. That's the discussion. That's all I have to say about the A1
okay.
amendment.
Okay. Any questions on the A1 amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor of Senator Sharon's A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails. All right. Thank you, Senator Sharon.
Yes, thank you. This is an appropriation in the biennium ending June 30th, 2017 from the General Fund to the Commissioner of Health to award money to a nonprofit that encourages families and communities to have discussions about end-of-life care. It has to be an organization that uses outreach, educational materials, testimonials to urge Minnesotans to have life stage discussions before they become necessary as a result of a necessary or end-of-life event. The funding would allow this organization to do this work and expand efforts statewide. I have with me persons who can speak both to the grant and to the role that this nonprofit organization plays in the state for encouraging communities to develop the capacity to have these conversations. And we could begin that now, if you wish, and then come
sure.
back to each of the bills.
Let's take testimony.
Okay, great. I think we might begin with our going to go to the movies.
Oh, that's
we
right.
We hope.
Okay.
Is this microphone on, do you know?
The audio is through that microphone, so make sure the microphone is close to the speaker. We'll all cross our fingers here. And
good at a lot of things. Hockey, fishing, predicting the weather. There are some things we're not so good at. Like, I don't know, talking about our feelings, especially when it comes to the things that make us uncertain or nervous, like discussing the type of care we want to receive when we reach the end of our lives. Not a fun topic, but it is important. Someday, we're all going to face some big decisions, and preparation is essential. For example, have we been clear about the treatments we want? How about the treatments we don't want? And how about the people who will be making these decisions on our behalf? Have we explained our preferences to them? See, not a fun topic. Besides, even if we are willing to talk about these issues, the details can be confusing. Maybe we're not even sure what we want. It all depends on the situation, right? I mean, how can we know? Are there documents to fill out? At the doctor? Online? And who can we talk to if we have questions? Maybe we're concerned our views will change, or that our wishes won't be followed no matter what we do. And let's be honest, for a lot of us, there's a superstitious stigma around this stuff. Just talking about it feels like tempting fate. But avoiding the conversation can come at a high price. If we don't do some planning, it can be nearly impossible for our loved ones and caregivers to understand our wishes, which makes it more likely we won't get the care we want, and sorting out the details will create a lot of pain and confusion for those who love us. And that's the key idea. Providing some direction can be one of the best gifts we ever give to the people we love. Knowing our preferences and sharing them is really important. Yes, it takes initiative and courage, but it does make conversations possible. Conversations that make certain our wishes are respected and understood. And that's the bottom line. End-of-life issues can be uncomfortable, but they matter. And people need help starting the discussion with their spouses, their parents, their adult children, and their care providers. And look at it this way. It doesn't take forever. A bit of work now, and we can be back to fishing in no time. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. You might recognize the voice and the work of David Gillette from TPT. This was one of the partnerships that existed with Honoring Choices and TPT to begin the work that they're doing to encourage these early conversations and talking now rather than waiting for crisis. So with that, I would like to have you hear for a few moments from Dr. Ken Kephart, who would like to talk to the capacities of a nonprofit organization like Honoring Choices to support these and other projects in the state, and what the value of the grant program will be throughout the state.
Dr. Kephart, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and provide your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Lori and committee members. My name is Ken Kephart. I'm a family physician and geriatrician. I've been working in the metro area for many years. I also have worked with some residency training programs. The last 6 years, I've also worked quite closely with the Twin City Medical Society and its Honoring Choices Project, which is a community and healthcare collaborative to try to advance discussions about advanced care planning before they're needed. As the a video kind of outlined, I think, well. If people wait until the time is needed for these decisions, it can be very problematic, stressful, and it can end up with people not having their wishes honored. I'll tell you, I spent Monday, 2 days ago, seeing about a dozen patients in a nursing home after they got out of the hospital. They are not there to live. They're there post-acute temporarily until they can get back on their feet and then usually go back home. Some of them won't make it. Of the 12 people I saw, the average age was 85. They just come out of a hospital. None had very clear advanced directives on what they wanted done if terrible things happened. Most still, in the absence of any information, would still get full treatment back to the hospital and ICU. Over half of them had significant cognitive problems, either dementia or stroke-related illness or medical problems that made it impossible for me to have very effective communication with them. Only one of those 12 had a advanced directive information I could find that allowed me to talk to a granddaughter who did, who had some conversation with her grandmother and was able to tell me what her grandmother would want in this situation that she was in, and I think we did the appropriate thing. The other 11, I had to struggle to get some kind of information. Most of the time, if there was a family present, they didn't feel comfortable making any decisions. They said, well, just talk to Mom. Well, Mom wasn't at a stage where she could understand or comprehend even a basic discussion. So this is what we see every day. So our goal is to try to have advanced discussions before they're needed, especially in places outside of a hospital, emergency room, or clinic, where people will be helped to initiate the discussion by somebody who's trained to start these hard conversations and can help ask the hard questions about things like, you know, who do you want to make a decision for you? Most people would say it's their spouse, if they have a spouse. Frequently, longtime spouses are unable to carry out somebody's wishes. It's too emotionally stressful for them. So unless you understand that, can ask other questions and ask the spouse if they'd be willing to follow a spouse's instructions that they'd like to die at home, for instance, instead of in a hospital, and would they be comfortable having that happen? Could they make that decision? You don't know. So you have to go in a little deeper. A lot of times adult children can step up and make those questions, but it takes somebody with some background and training to help lead those discussions to a fruitful place. I think the organization that Honoring Choices, what we've done is taken a very successful program that's been proven for a couple of decades in La Crosse, Wisconsin. We use their proven training method for our facilitators. And what we do that the health systems can't do effectively is work outside of the clinics and hospitals. So the health systems are working hard trying to change their culture and asking questions when people come into the hospital and in the clinics. But a lot of people aren't part of an established clinic. They don't, if they do go to a clinic or end up in the emergency room, they don't necessarily trust the system. They may not be familiar with our culture. They could be people who just have a basic distrust of the health system. So having those conversations in a trusted place in their faith community, in a community center, is what we do that the health systems can't do. And that's why we're here to ask for support. And the health systems can take care of the issues inside their system, but they can't and haven't been able to effectively reach other populations that need this discussion. And that's really what the community grant project is all about. I'll just close with a few facts. When you ask people how they'd want to end their life, they're pretty clear, and it's pretty clear that their wishes aren't being honored. So 25% of people see 10 or more physicians in their last 6 months of life, and that speaks of the complexity of the medical care in this time. Many physicians are involved. It can be very confusing for families and patients to sort out what the best route is. Families don't know a majority of time what their loved one would want, even if the patients think they do. And we aren't dying where we want to die. 7 of 10 would prefer to die at home. Only 15% actually do end up dying at home. Nearly 70% die in a hospital, nursing home, or long-term care facility. And we don't engage hospice at home early enough or often enough to help that wish be fulfilled. I think we can do better than that. I think our program has started making some inroads, and we're just asking for support to continue that work. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Kephart.
Dr. Kephart. We have Dr. Johnson, is that correct?
Yes, Dr. Chris Johnson. I thought you might, there were a number of wonderful stories from physicians that I met with last week about the experiences they were having. And one of the physicians I didn't bring here really was quite articulate about the amount of pain that is involved in poor decision making for the clients. I've not asked him to come, saved you from having to hear some of the stories, but I did want you to hear from Dr. Chris Johnson, who we really appreciate is taking time from his practice today. He's an emergency room physician, and I thought you should hear some of what he talked about when we were reviewing this project with their organization.
Dr. Johnson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Chris Johnson. I'm an emergency medicine physician. I practice at Methodist Hospital in St. Louis Park, and I've been there for the last 11 years. I just wanted to give my thoughts and my experiences as an emergency medicine doctor about the importance of giving patients and families resource to have these kinds of conversations before they arrive to me in chaos. And the reason to give them support is that these are not natural conversations to have. Natural conversations are about when hockey practices and grocery stores. People don't come home and saying, you know, I've been thinking about my mortality for the last 2 hours, and I want to talk to all of you about it. But that conversation inevitably happens, and it usually happens in front of me. And it can happen in one of two ways. It can happen with the family saying, our grandmother, our mother, here's what she talked about. We all had a big meeting about this, and these were what she wanted. The other way, which is far more common, and for some reason happens at midnight on a Sunday, is something happens, one family member arrives, and the other family members might be in New York or California, and they're just in complete distress. They're crying. They can't understand. And they're like, I can't make that decision. What do we do? I don't know. Let me get on the phone. I can't reach them. And it's a miserable experience for everyone, and right now we're trying to do what's best for the patient. I will give you an example that I even just had this past weekend, which is far more what we hope would be more the model for the future, which is I had an 81-year-old patient who was on a blood thinner because of a heart rhythm on that for years, and that morning she had a stroke, and a large one, and a bleeding one, and the pressure was rapidly building up, and she's becoming less and less responsive. And she comes in emergently, and we find the bleed on a head CT, and the family comes in later, very, very soon. And I talked to them, and they told me very specifically, she told us that I know this might happen with this blood thinner I have to take for my heart condition, but I don't want to go to a nursing home. I don't want tubes through my throat. I don't want a new feeding tube going through my belly. Mm-hmm. And we were able to treat that patient compassionately. We didn't have to intubate when we could have. But the patient, less responsive now, was still running her care. And the family did exactly what she wanted and was at peace. And there wasn't chaos. There wasn't blame and resentment and confusion in a situation that's already sad and already kind of unplanned. But it was exactly what the patient wanted, and the family could say goodbye by her side, knowing that they honored their beloved family member till the end. And we hope that with programs like this, that can be what happens more often than not. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Johnson. I do know from a few personal experiences that the conflict that can occur amongst families. I mean, nobody's going to be in the same place about how to care for somebody that's in this position that doesn't have an advanced plan put together. And so it's a tremendously stressful and conflict-ridden process for many of them that I've actually personally witnessed. So I think this is valuable work to be doing. Thank you for spearheading it.
Senator Lori, we also have with us Sue Shettle from the who is the Chief Executive Officer for the Twin Cities Medical Society, who will be able to answer very specific questions about the fiscal note. But instead of asking for that now, I think I'll turn it back to you for questions that you may have on either of the bills, and if there are questions specifically about how some of these resources would be utilized, I'm sure that Ms. Shuttle will answer those questions for you.
Okay. Well, we have Senate File 407 still before us, so maybe we'll take that one, which is the second appropriation. I saw in the fiscal note that there's about, you know, it is the grant, and then about $17,000 for administration of that grant, a 0.15 FTE, is that what I saw? Yeah, 0.25 FTE.
0.25, this is
and 0.15 each year thereafter. So 0.25 in the first year, a quarter of an FTE in the first year, and then 0.15 of an FTE in subsequent years, it looks like. Any questions on Senate File 407, rather? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, 407 or 410? I'm sorry, I guess my question was on 407.
Your question is on which?
407.
Well, that's the one
we
have before
410.
Us right now. Yeah. Your question is on the first one?
410.
410, okay. Any questions on 407?
Just Senator to be clear, Sharon. this one, 407, is the appropriation to a nonprofit organization that does purchases the information, the perhaps you could describe the word to describe. There is a curriculum. That's the word I'm looking for, a curriculum that requires a purchasing and trains the trainers to be able to assist hospitals, physicians, spiritual leaders, community leaders to engage in these conversations. So this particular 407 is talking about the appropriation to that nonprofit organization.
Okay. So this one, yeah, is for developing the grants to build the infrastructure in local communities to be able to foster in those communities this conversation in a much...
Yes, and I might say that there is an organization that does this in the state that has really been funded very piecemealish by nonprofits, by hospitals, by insurance companies, and sort of some initiative funds to see if this effort in a collaborative way could create some better conversations, because these organizations were seeing the crisis that has been described here. They're now coming forward and saying we'd like some more confidence and sustainability in resources, and are hoping that we can help make the contribution to their ongoing efforts. So that's what this is about.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Senator Sharon. I'm actually a co-author on both of the bills and was at your press conference on this. However, I guess my question with 407, you talk about the building, the sustainability for this group that's already doing it. Is there something written in the statute, or should be written in the statute, as far as coming back to the legislature with the outcomes, how many people they have talked to, just some accountability built into it, knowing that the $750,000 for each biennium has been properly used. If they already have some of the system already built up, I'd just like to know.
Senator Sharon.
I'd say, Senator, I really appreciate that recommendation, and I will make certain. I suspect that this will be laid on the table, and then we'll come back at some point. Is that correct, Senator Laurie?
Yes, this would be laid on the table for possible inclusion.
To get that kind of language about reporting back and articulating what has been achieved with the expenditures. Thank you for that suggestion.
And it sounds like we have some good baseline statistics. I think it was 15% of individuals coming through have some sort of advanced care directive is what I think I recall hearing. Maybe we could use a benchmark like that as part of the reporting thing. Are we actually making progress and seeing a larger percentage of individuals that are going through this coming forward with an advanced care directive, just a raw number of advanced care directives that get accomplished? But yeah, I think that would be a valuable thing for us to be able to have as we move forward.
I think we should, we'll talk about that, but I would want to broaden the conversation. This is about more than having written living will or advanced care directive. It's much more than that. It has to do with training, how many we're going to, we may just begin in this first couple of years to be able to develop the training of people in communities who over a long period of time will have the skill set to engage community members in these kinds of earlier life conversations about how do you want to control your life. But the so I just wanted to say that because it does, this conversation often gets narrowed down to that.
Yeah.
But the, really the objective is much larger than that. And so, but the concept of developing some language about feeding back on what is accomplished with the money, I will work on that before it comes before the committee again.
Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure if we're on 410 or 407.
We're on 407 still.
Okay. Then I'll hold my questions till 410. Thank you.
We'll go back. We laid 410 on the table.
Right.
And went to 407.
I guess, Mr. Chair, this might be in part a 407 question, but we're pretty narrowly tailoring. Oh, my goodness, I can't talk. I apologize. Tailoring this bill to one organization, and we had approached the idea of carving out for organizations with some hesitancy. Do we have any fiscal information on this organization? What's their current budget? You know, some of those basic questions, because we've called them out pretty specifically, and if their total budget is half of what we're appropriating, then we're making a significant investment. And do we have that?
This is one of that's through a competitive grant process. It's not, I mean, Senator Perrin did say that there is an organization, but I don't know as we know for sure that that organization would be the one that would be successful. We can certainly, I'd like to get a response to that, but we pay particularly close attention when it's a direct appropriation to a nonprofit, and we actually try to encourage people, members, to come forward with a bill that's constructed like this as a competitive grant process so that we have some of that additional work done prior to awarding the grant.
But and I appreciate that, Mr. Chair, but we've only heard from one entity. It seems one entity is going to check all the boxes. It just feels a little directed to me.
And no, so absolutely. Like, and so I do want a response to your question. I'm just putting a little context.
Thank you, Senator.
Yes,
Senator Benson. We are on that kind of funny spot that in a competitive grant, which we want to do when we're awarding these dollars, but what the grantee needs to have in place really narrows who will be eligible for the grant, which is what I think Senator Benson recognizes. But I didn't want to lay out the exact way in which a particular organization would utilize these resources because we didn't want to have a particular organization be the only potential grantee. We want to open it to others if that's in the case. But I can provide for Senator Benson what, if it was awarded to Honoring Choices, how they would utilize the resources.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions on Senate File 407? Seeing none, Senator Sharon, move Senate File 407 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, any further questions? Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to speak, either in support or opposition to Senate File 407? Seeing none, on Senator Sharon's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senate File 410, then. The other grant. And Senator Sharon, just a general question. Is it your intent, is this sort of an either or are you looking to do both of these? Or
These are separate bills, but they really are partners. The bill that is in front of you now adds the capacity for communities to develop in the similar way that we designed the statewide health improvement plan, which has a grassroots analysis of where the community is in relationship to a goal of having these community conversations, and then that community, each community, based on how they assess where they're at, creates a proposal for how to achieve the objectives of this bill and presents it for to compete for the dollars that are in the grant bill. The other bill is providing resources for an organization that's already trying to do this in the metro area, and some of the rural parts of the state would like to continue to do that and expand their resources throughout the state, and they struggle to continue to do what they're doing now unless we are able to support them in that initiative. This bill that's in front of you now takes it to the community level, helps communities design and engage in an activity that this organization then will provide technical support for. They're partners.
And this fiscal note is the $250,000 a year, plus it looks like about $150,000 in FTEs for and overhead and supplies per year, plus $60,000 to monitor the quality of the program, and $25,000 for collection of minimal analysis of the data every other year. So that'd be a total of about little over $200,000 of admin costs to the department for administering this $500,000 grants. Is that correct?
That's correct. $60,000 a year and $25,000 in the first
year.
I'm
sorry. Yes.
It's $120,000 and then...
Okay, any questions on Senate File 410? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, we called out 10% of this grant for technical support. Would that be going to the same organizations that were eligible for the other bill?
Senator Sharon?
Yes.
That seems like a lot of money going to... And I know we are not targeting a specific organization, but I think we need to take a really hard look at how much money this one organization is getting. What's their total budget? I know it's a competitive grant, but I have some pretty serious heartburn. How much are we putting into an organization? Are we doubling their budget? So I would like to, before this gets included, and I know... Watch your pennies and the dollars take care of themselves isn't real popular at the legislature, but this seems like one of those situations. And then to the $5 million overall spend, how many people are we going to serve?
Senator Sharon?
Thank you. I'll be happy to. I am in this kind of funny situation. I think we can give some numbers that talk about why the 10% exists and what it will produce and why it's necessary in relationship to the grant. It's related to the amount of support that would be needed for grants. For example, one of these grants might be with a community that is non-English speaking, and so the amount of time and resources and technical support for a project that will try to deal with culturally diverse communities may be different than it would be for if a nonprofit, a hospital or something, has already gone through the training because of a relationship with an organization like Honoring Choices, might have a different project that requires less technical support. So it's difficult for me to say exactly what that will be, but we'll lay out for you what we know, understanding that we're talking about our experience with a specific organization that is designed already to do this task. And then the other, how many will we serve? This will be part of what we'll do an analysis on. It's very similar to the SHIP grant in this way that it allows the community to define itself and draw the parameters around who they are and what they will do and how many they will serve and what it will cost them to do that. So it's difficult for me to say up front even how many grants that there will be. So I'm leaving the granting process to the Department of Health to review the proposals to determine those that best achieve the objectives of the bill, and to distribute them in the manner and in the way that's defined within the bill. But I do think that we want to review this. I think we have language that has to come back in for review 2 times a year to the Department of Health, and that we will look at how this is rolling out and what impact we're having as we move forward.
Senator Benson, a follow-up?
Mr. Chair and Senator Sharon, this is a lot of money, and we usually don't just push money out. If I look at this competing, and you are the chair of the Housing Committee, competing for homelessness and low-income housing, I need some statistics to really be comfortable this is the right number. And maybe it needs to be a pilot project targeted at an at-risk community. I feel like we need to have more evidence that this is going to accomplish its goals and ultimately save us public health dollars or improve some community's understanding of end-of-life planning. I feel like we need something more solid than we're going to put $5 million out and then we'll tell you what happens. These are important conversations. I understand why you're carrying the bill. I have empathy for the doctors and families that are involved. I'm just not used to putting $5 million out without accountability. I look at the next bill, or federally qualified health centers are asking for $2 million. They came to me with, we're spending this on IT, this on personnel. I'm really hesitant to support this provision as constructed.
Senator Sharon.
Hi, my name is Sue Shuttle. I'm the CEO of the Twin Cities Medical Society and the Executive Director of the Honoring Choices Program. This is a program of the Medical Society. Physicians, as you've heard today, get this issue, and so this has been something that we've prioritized over the last 5 or 6 years. We've been, Dr. Kephart alluded to the fact that we're using a model based in La Crosse, Wisconsin. It's called Respecting Choices. That is, I use the analogy often when I describe our program that it's a house, and the bottom floor, and maybe even the first floor, is respecting choices, but everything on top of that is honoring choices. We have, we're doing a lot of work in the community. It's mostly based in the metro. We're a metro-based medical society, so it makes sense that we serve our constituents, but we have really the opportunity to expand this work outstate. So some of the successes that we've had through this model is we've been able to get the healthcare systems all around the table, much like what you are doing here today, to agree to not compete, to work together and collaborate for the advancement of this issue. They said, we would like you as Honoring Choices, as a neutral convener, to convene this work and move it forward. And so that's a huge success in the healthcare market because of having that collaboration. We've trained over 1,700 people to have discussions in the metro area on advanced care planning. Most of them are in healthcare settings, but we do have a lot of them in community-based settings as well. We have a number of ambassadors. We have a number of volunteers that are actually our cultural brokers and go out and have conversations and engage people. So this is really a public health initiative that truly has a lot of moving parts on any given day. I can tell you that Minnesota is actually when you compare nationally advanced care planning or the completion of a healthcare directive, we are actually ahead of the national average. We're at like 34%, and compared to the national average, which is 25 or 26%. So we're making a lot of progress. I'm kind of going through my testimony here a little bit on Senate File 407. I can stop at this point if you'd like, or if you have particular questions, I'm glad to.
Well, Ms. Shuttle, I think the question was more about, what are we going to do with the money? and how is it You know, how does the structure work? And I think part of it, this, you know, we have administration costs at MDH that awards grants and I think supports grantees in some manner to try to help them make sure that they can comply. And then in addition to that, you know, a little more than $200,000 of management to award grants, we have another 10% to support, you know, grantees in their development of grants. And it, you know, when we read it, it's not clear that that's not duplicative work. And yeah. So how's the, you know, I mean, how's the money going to be used is really, I think, Senator Benson, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I think that's really what we're trying to get at in reading this. We have two kind of fairly similar pieces.
We can clarify that. And also, I think that I was sensitive to this issue about using Honoring Choices as the organization that we're really talking about here, because there really isn't another like it anywhere in the state. But we don't often just direct money to a specific organization. So I was sensitive to that comment that was made somewhere along the line. And so that sort of has tied me up in terms of being able to talk about things. But I think I think also that Senator Benson was saying, and I will go back with Honoring Choices here to say, as a result of these initiatives that they've taken, what have their outcomes been? Besides just the numbers of contacts, you know, does making this contact result in this improved, you know, showing more specifically what we were describing here is that we are showing a higher rate of success of having these conversations as a result mm-hmm. of these efforts as opposed to other states, and that these initiatives, as much has been organized and started, already have an outcome. And now we want to take it more broadly, allow people to do this in their community, to continue to move that dashboard forward. And that was the other part of the question that I heard from Senator Benson.
You know, I have one other question. Honoring Choices, whatever the name of it is, it was described as a project of the Twin Cities Medical Society. Is it a formal nonprofit? I mean, would it even be eligible to apply for this grant? It is a separately established.
It is a project of our foundation, which is a 501c3.
Okay.
And so this is the main initiative of our foundation.
Good enough. Any other questions? Seeing none, anyone else in the audience wish to speak either in support or opposition to Senate File 410? Seeing none, Senator Sharon moves that Senate File 410, as amended, be recommended to pass and laid on the table for possible inclusion. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator Sharon. Senator Hayden. Senator Hayden, Senate File 622. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members.
Oh, yeah, we've got some handouts.
How are you?
Senator Hayden.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I have Senate File 622, which is the FQHC's federally qualified health care provision. Senate File 622 provides the state 17 federally qualified health care centers, or FQHCs, with a $2 million increase to the existing $2.5 million appropriation from the Department of Health. The appropriation was established in 2007. Per statute, directs the state's FQHCs quote, to continue, expand, and improve the federally qualified health center services to low-income populations. The state's FQHCs are located in both rural and inner cities, the both rural Minnesota and the inner cities of Minneapolis and St. Paul. They target primary care services to roughly 180,000 low-income and uninsured individuals annually. These organizations are on the front lines of reducing healthcare disparities. Nearly 7% of their patients come from communities of color. In addition, 13 of the 17 FQHCs are participating in DHS's medical assistance demonstration programs. This participation has led to some key findings that form the basis of the $2 million request. Consequently, the FQHCs are focusing on four priority areas: improved care coordination, enhanced data analytics, expand access to care, addressing oral health care needs. The Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers tasked its memberships to identify specific projects that the FQHCs would undertake under the four priority areas. They've identified 40 specific projects that would impact the state's over 75,000 would impact over 75,000 existing and new low-income patients throughout the state. With me, I have Jenny Johnson from the association, along with individuals from the health center, individual health center representatives who will give you a deeper understanding of the request today.
Thank you, Mr. Senator Hayden. Ms. Johnson, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jenny Johnson, and I am with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. As Senator Hayden said, we are the member association of Minnesota's 17 federally qualified health centers. It is our mission to serve everyone who comes through our doors, regardless of their ability to pay. And we serve approximately 180,000 individuals from low-income and diverse communities who would otherwise face many barriers to accessing health care. We offer them medical, dental, and mental behavioral health services all under one roof, which is really kind of one of our calling cards to the communities that we serve. I'll speak very broadly to the bill and then really hand it off to our two clinics representatives to get into detail about how they would invest these fundings. Senate File 622 does seek a $2 million increase to our current health center appropriation. The health centers receive this appropriation from the Department of Health's Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. And we invest this money in a variety of activities to improve patient services. And those include HIT, expanding access and services, patient education, and chronic care. And we'd like to thank the committee for the current appropriation, which is sitting at $2.5 million. It is set to decrease in the years 2016 and 2017 by about $120,000. And so we're seeking an increase of $2 million to the appropriation. This committee did press upon us, or pressed us, to develop a detailed plan outlining how we would invest this additional funding and the impact on it. And we'd like to thank the committee, particularly Senator Benson, for impressing upon us the importance of really speaking to how we'll be good stewards to this funding. And to that, we do have a handout. This chart in your packets does outline and describe how we will invest the funding, the number of additional FTEs that it would provide, and the number of patients that would be impacted by the work. Broadly speaking, our 17 members would invest this money into 44 different projects or investments for patient services, and they would fall into four large buckets, if you will: care coordination, data analytics, expanded access to current services, and expanded oral health services. Overall, this would impact or bring in nearly 60,000 FTEs into the primary care system, and it would impact about 85,000 federally qualified health center patients in a positive way. I want to highlight what Senator Hayden said about innovation. 13 of our members are currently participating in a Medicaid demonstration project, and it's really the learnings of those projects that drive, that are really driving two really important pieces of the buckets that, or two of the buckets that we would invest this funding into. As health centers, we do want to participate in health reform and continue to participate in innovations that are being delivered. We believe that our patients also deserve those same best practices that other individuals in the market are able to access through their providers. In particular, 10 of our urban FQHCs are participating in a network known as FUN, or the Federally Qualified Urban Health Network, and it's their learnings that are really driving this request and where we would invest the money. They found that in the first 12 months of their project, they saw a 10% decrease in emergency department utilization, and were a significant contributor to the state savings through that project. And so I really just want to highlight that they came back and said it was really care coordination and data analytics in a really robust way that really helped them to drive those results. And so just to speak to the care coordination, they found that it is a key component to really helping patients understand and access all of the appropriate services that they would need. It helps them navigate the care that they would need to receive from all providers, not just from the medical side. And we found that it often constitutes a rather different understanding or knowledge base than perhaps what a medical, direct medical provider or doctor would be able to provide. And for cost efficiency reasons, we thought that it should be a separate, it is a separate role within the clinic. And this also allows our providers to work at the top of their license and continue to treat patients as a medical provider. Within data analytics, we really feel that it's imperative that we be able to analyze our data to identify where to best target our resources and efforts. Examples of that are where to enhance case management, establish and identify which patients would be best benefited from care coordination, and really continue to improve our care or integrate our care coordination across different services that we provide. And so I'd like to thank the committee, and I would like to turn it over then to Jen Thieneman from Open Door Health Center, and I'm happy to stay for questions after.
Hello.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jen Thieneman. I'm COO at Open Door Health Center. Open Door Health Center began in 1994 as a volunteer-based clinic in response to the needs of women and children who did not have access to health care opportunities. The primary location in Mankato offers integrated medical, dental, and behavioral health services to people from across the southern Minnesota region. In addition to our fixed site, we offer the same services on a mobile medical clinic and a mobile dental clinic that brings our care, which is identical to our main site, closer to people in smaller rural communities that are at a distance from Mankato. This program began in 2012 as an effective way to meet the needs of the underserved and improve health equity to those who are most at risk but unlikely utilizing the traditional healthcare services. Our mobile clinics travel regularly to locations in Worthington, Marshall, and Gaylord. Additionally, our mobile medical clinic also offers event-based care as needed to a variety of locations throughout the region. Open Door has grown by 200% since becoming an FQHC, or Federally Qualified Health Center, in 2009. In 2014, 7,000 people were served, over 4,700 in dental, 2,500 in medical, and 230 medical mental health clients. We now employ 80 staff members, and of the patients that see us, 95% are below 200% of poverty, over half or 100% are below. And since Open Door is the only federally qualified health center in southern Minnesota, we reach a pretty broad geographic impact, and a handout has been included in your packet to show a little bit more about where our patients and clients live. At the present time, Open Door has a number of patient-focused initiatives taking place. The first is that we are almost finished with a complete renovation and expansion of our building to better meet our patient needs, as well as allow more space for additional care coordination and a space to better address our dental waiting lists that are consistently over 300 people each month. The second is the expansion of our integrated behavioral health care. A large portion of our patients have complicating factors that need to be addressed by behavioral health professionals and not always best done by our medical and dental staff. We have added staff who can provide assessment and counseling, including addressing chemical health. And we have also added one behavioral health provider to our clinical team who provides immediate consultation, assessment, and intervention with a warm handoff by a primary care or a dental provider. Finally, we recognize that many dental patients seek care due to pain but may not be engaged in regular primary or preventive care. We are using our successful experience with care coordination to begin a small, new, innovative project targeting dental patients by identifying those while they're in the dental department and drawing them into our primary care services to best meet their overall health needs. With additional funds from the CHC appropriation, Open Door Health Center will be able to add an additional dental provider to meet our growing need, which as of yesterday was 464 patients on our waiting list. Generally, 10 appointments take care of each patient, so that's quite a number of visits that we need to take care of. Invest in staff for care coordination with a focus on high-cost patients as identified by state numbers through our efforts with the Medicaid demonstration project. The emphasis will be to build a relationship with patients who have had high emergency department utilization and draw them into routine primary care supported by our care team. And finally, improve our data analytics to support our quality initiatives and utilize data to strengthen our business-making decisions. We also need to enhance our existing electronic medical record to include behavioral health for data analytical purposes. And in conclusion, community health centers specialize in addressing challenging risk factors in a cost-effective way with the goal of being not only good financial stewards, but also yielding cost savings over the long term. Additional funds would be invested in the region immediately and have a benefit to patients, families, and the medical community. This, in turn, leads to a healthier, more reliable regional workforce. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. I'll take questions at this time.
Thank you. Did you have one more testifier, Senator Hayden? And then we'll move to questions. If you do, we can.
Yes, Mr. Chair. It looks like we have one more.
Okay. Is that Ms. McDonald-Diouf with the Community University Health Center? I probably butchered your name. Sorry about that. But welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Colleen McDonald-Joof. I'm Associate Director at the Community University Healthcare Center. We're also called COOC, so if you hear me say that name, that's where it comes from. Cookie, yeah. First, I wanted to thank you for the existing appropriation that we receive from the state for covering a lot of our work that we do that's non-billable. So we appreciate that to start with. And today I'm here to tell you a little bit about what we're doing and why we're asking for care coordination and increase in funding for data analytics. Our clinic is located in the Phillips neighborhood. We've been in South Minneapolis, which has been around since 1966. We serve 11,000 people a year. We offer a breadth and depth of medical, mental health, and dental services. We have very complex patients. About 20% of our patients have a serious and persistent mental illness, which is a little unusual for community clinics. And 96 of our patients are living 200% below poverty. So very, very sick and very poor. We employ about 175 staff, and half of those staff come from the communities we serve. We also offer wraparound services through partnerships with like a private law firm such as Stinson & Leonard Street that offers pro bono legal services. So we do offer a wide range of services to help our folks. We are also a training institution, which is why you hear the university in our name. We're an outreach site, and we serve, we train 250 students and residents a year from the schools of nursing, dental, pharmacy, social work, and different departments within medicine. And then we're also, again, kind of early innovators and looking at different models of care that are more cost-effective and better for our patients that meet what we call the triple aim. Well, as you know, of the triple aim, improving patient care, improving patient experience, and reducing total cost of care. So we are one of the participating fun clinics, and we do have fun. It's a hard project, but we enjoy it. And so what we're asking for today is for some funding to double. As we've been working in fun, we've found that one of the most effective strategies we have is care coordination coupled with data analytics. So with our 11,000 patients, at least 2,200 are sort of the highest risk utilization bands in our population. And with our care coordination services, we are able to target those risk utilization folks, high-risk folks, and give them all the care around the whole person so that they, number one, are using the emergency room less and are less risk for hospitalization that's avoidable. So just to give you two great examples, we had a man who we found out with our data analytics that we're getting, the claims data we're getting, had 42 visits in 1 year to the ER. Huge. We never got that data. We didn't have that data to operate. So we saw that. We said, wow, this is interesting. So we worked with him. We've actually been working with him for over a year now. He was homeless. He would drink because he also had schizophrenia, and so every time you would hear voices in his head, he would drink so that he would black out so he wouldn't hear them anymore. And he had a seizure disorder. So anytime we'd try to help him, or he'd go to the ER or go to other places, he would be drinking, and then he would pass out, and then all of his medications would disappear. So when we first started working with him, he was talking about the next life he wanted. He didn't feel that he had more life on this planet for today. Now he's talking about how he's now found housing. He goes to the ER once a month, which is a huge decrease from 42 visits. And he's talking about future goals, current goals, as work is one of them. You know, how can I maintain my care so I can start going back to work? So that's one great example. And that was the work of our great pharmacy resident that we had, as well as our care coordinator. We also had a woman who had diabetes. She had almost done, okay, young child, and she was experiencing domestic abuse, and we had to get her out of that situation first so that she could then start getting on her diabetes care and managing her diabetes. And so now she's doing really well with that. But again, services that can't happen in a 15 to 20 minute visit that have really improved her overall patient indicators and kept her family intact. So those are the two things I liked today. Sorry, I'm the one suffering from asthma. So we welcome any questions. Sorry.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson was testifying that there was a reduction in your funding level, something that was confusing the staff a little bit. Maybe we could get a little bit of clarity on that. I know another member or two has a question as well, but I guess we didn't quite understand what you were saying about a reduction in funding.
Yes, Mr. Chair. And so at the end of last year, there was a small increase awarded to the health center appropriation, but in the tails in 2016 and 17, that small increase is going away. It's not an ongoing increase.
Okay. We'll take a look at that. How much of an increase was it?
Mr. Chair, it was approximately
$300,000. Okay. All right, and then a question. Are these services that you're offering, are these ones that wouldn't be able to be provided? So, I mean, with this, you're going to have 12,577 additional clients served with dental services and the additional care coordination and access. These are all services that would not otherwise be able to be provided, correct?
Mr. Chair, this is a combination of services that would be new and added, as well as existing services that would be expanded. And so when we talk about total patients who would be impacted, it's a combination of new patients who will be able to now access some of these services for the first time, as well as current health center patients who would have additional benefits from the enhanced services.
Okay. Senator Brown?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question, I guess, kind of leads into what you just asked. You're almost doubling your funding, which I'm not saying that I'm opposed to, but what are some of the new services? I'm just wondering if you could give some practical examples beyond the data, and maybe it's mainly for data analytics and reducing the dental waiting list, but you mentioned some new services. Could you give me some practical examples of what that would be?
Ms. Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown. Some of the new services, I think, really what we would focus on are additional care coordinators, and I guess it's not entirely accurate to say they're brand new services. There are services that we are currently offering in many of our clinics, but we are not being reimbursed for those current services. And so to have some more funding to be able to support those services and expand the number of patients who can access care coordinators, I think would be one example of how we would perceive it as being a new service.
Senator Rao?
Mr. Chair, could you give me an example of what that means for a layperson or someone who comes in off the street to enhance the care coordinator? What does that mean? What benefit is that to the potential patient or client?
Ms. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I may defer that to Ms. McDonald Diouf.
Be happy to answer. So what that means is when you come into appointment, often you come into appointment and you leave. A care coordinator is going to say, okay, Senator Brown, you have diabetes. How are you managing your diabetes? They might call you. They might help you put a medication regime together if you're having difficulty. They might talk to you about what goals in exercise and weight loss you need to achieve. They might help you address any barriers that you're having to remembering or to starting to make those changes in your life. So, in effect, and let's just say you don't have any money with your diabetes medications, they might help you find assistance programs so you can access your diabetes medications that you need. And they're going to check in with you. They're going to see that we're reducing all the barriers that you need to be effectively managing your diabetes. So that would be one difference, yeah.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, one last question. Senator Hayden, I'm just wondering how you came up with the $2 million. Did you ask the federal qualified health centers what their needs were and kind of group all that together? Was it an arbitrary number? I'm wondering, to me it sounds like there's a great need. Why not $5 million versus $2 million? I'm just wondering how you came up with the number.
Well, thank you, Senator Brown, Mr. Chair. This bill was brought to me by the Community Healthcare Centers. This is the analysis that they had done throughout their system. So I would suggest that Ms. Johnson can probably continue to support that. But this is the number in which they came to me and felt that would be the appropriate amount for the next coming biennium.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions on Senate File 622? Ms. Johnson, did you want to give further?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Brown. I was just going to follow up. Yes, that is correct. It was based on a needs assessment that the health centers did in the previous 6 months.
Okay. Ms. McDonald-Duff? Oh, Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and nobody's asked a geography question yet, and we rarely get through these things without that. I was looking at the maps, and notice, say, for Senator Brown's district and my district, I'm wondering how our communities are served, because I see attention to rural, and I see a high concentration in the metro, and if you could just talk to me a little bit about how homelessness needs are met in suburban and exurban areas.
New testifier, Mr. Watson, yeah. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jonathan Watson. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers. And Senator Besson, to your point, geographically, you look at the map, and we're only in, I think, 17 of Minnesota's 87 counties. But our data run looks at we're serving over 50% of the state's zip codes. We're finding people traveling tremendous distances to access care. Often these are individuals who are uninsured or underinsured, and the community health center may be the only place for them to receive services, in a sense. And also in dental care, just the amount of transportation people are driving. One of my stories is an individual woman from Blaine who drives up to Floodwood, actually, to receive her dental services. So just because we don't have a dot in your county, it doesn't mean that we don't serve some of your patients. And I do have that data. I'd be happy to follow up with you in terms of the constituents that, of yours that rely on a community health center.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just for members' benefit, Floodwood is in Tomasoni's district,
exactly.
A long way from Blaine.
Correct.
Yes, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 622? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 622. Be recommended to pass and lay down the table for possible inclusion on that motion. Any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Now we have the last bill, Senate File 797, Local Public Health Grants.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senate File 797, which is an increase of funding to the local public health grant. Mr. Chair, members, according to the recent national report, Minnesota's investment in public health ranks 44th in the nation, and Senate File 797 seeks to improve that. According to the Minnesota Department of Health, per capita funding from the LPH, or the local public health grant, has declined substantially and steadily since the act was passed in the 1970s and has not kept pace with inflation. Many local health departments lack the capacity to respond to a changing demographics, health disparities, and emerging issues like chlamydia or Ebola, for example. We believe that the increased investment will help to improve access to services offered and save the state money in the long run. For example, pregnant women who receive WIC have fewer premature and low birth weight babies. The medical cost for a premature low birth baby averages $49,000 in the first year versus $4,551 for a baby born without complications. With me today, I have Renee Fraun
Dietz.
Got it. The local public health division director in Stearns County Human Service.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Renee Fraundienst, and I am the Public Health Division Director for Stearns County. I'm also the Community Health Services Administrator for Stearns County and Benton County as well. Mr. Chair, if I could just introduce one person this morning. I have Lorna Schmidt with me, who is the new local public health director for the local public health, the local public health association director, and I just wanted to introduce her as well, so you would see our new director. This is her actually second day here, and I just wanted to take the opportunity to share that with you. So.
Excellent.
Today I'm here in the capacity as the legislative co-chair for the local public health association, which is an affiliate of the Association of Minnesota Counties. And it represents city, county, and tribal public health agencies across the state that work to keep Minnesotans healthy and safe. Restoring the local public health grant funding is a priority for the local public health association. It is also a priority for our other local governmental consortiums, the Association of Minnesota Counties, and also the Minnesota Intercounty Association. Local public health agencies across Minnesota are the backbone of prevention and early response to community issues and priorities. We're similar to law enforcement in that we have been charged with maintaining the health and safety of our citizen. We do this work not in isolation, but in partnership with many of our community agencies, clinics, hospitals, etc. The Minnesota statute identifies what the role of public health is in the community, and it outlines the requirement that we must do an assessment plan, implement and evaluate activities that address community needs in the six priority areas or areas of responsibility, which is in maintaining an infrastructure, preventing infectious diseases, promoting healthy communities and behaviors, assuring access to health services, protecting against environmental hazards, and then last, assisting communities to respond to and recover from disaster. This work is considered core activities for public health and involves coordinating and educating and convening our key partners in the community to address the unique and the many needs that we have within each community. For us, it requires a strong framework of people and skills, a foundation of resources that can meet not only the normal needs, but the constantly changing emerging needs over time. Over the past several years, this foundation has been crumbling. As with many other systems, the base that has sustained the foundation of the local public health system has eroded. Local units of government have tried to fill the gap, but have limited resources and no longer can continue to pour the amount of local property taxes into the fissure that has been created. The main source of the state's investment in Minnesota's public health systems and infrastructure is the local public health grant, which is today being looked at. These dollars are intended to support local public health services across the state, and it does provide local policymakers with the ability to direct those dollars to areas where the need has been identified. This is a flexible grant, and it's used to address local issues. It is commonly used across the state to respond to some of our emerging chronic diseases, but a lot of times our infectious disease outbreaks or situations like TB cases, pertussis cases, or follow-up, measles follow-up, foodborne outbreaks, and then planning for Ebola with local partners, just as some examples. These dollars were first appropriated with the local public health statute that was enacted in 1976, and they were intended to support the core functions that are outlined in the statute, but they have decreased steadily from $7.25 per capita to $3.90 per capita. And you heard earlier that it places Minnesota 44th in the nation in our investment in public health. In 2003, in response to the state budget deficit, the local public health grant was reduced by 29%, and these dollars have never been reinstated. With this loss, there were many programs and services and staff that were lost across local public health agencies. Just a couple examples. There were cuts in outreach to children with potential developmental delays. There were community safety net clinic services that were eliminated, public health laboratory resources that were cut, immunization services to our underinsured individuals were cut, and education activities around youth using alcohol, just to highlight a few. Our communities have recognized the gap that's been produced with these reductions, and they have been unable to completely fill the need there as well. They also acknowledge the loss of these resources as a critical factor in the health of the community and also in the health of their public health agency. Most recently, we just collected some data that indicates that local public health spent over $300,000 from October to December in the Ebola response work. With continuing outbreaks such as the recent measles cases, restoring the funding is critical in order for the local ability to respond to these and other constantly emerging situations to occur. These types of activities are currently falling on the local property tax, and an increase in the local public health grant would assist. Investing in local public health systems do pay off. We know that investments in individual-focused programs like WIC, home visiting, produce savings to direct medical costs and also to some of the other systems that we interact with, such as corrections and child protection. Okay. Thank you. We do have some emerging research that shows that their investments in the system actually reduce mortality in both child and heart disease. Reinvesting in these dollars would assist the local tax levy and would also be a wise investment in our communities at the local level. Thank you. I'll take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Schmidt, did you wish to offer testimony as well? No? Well, I'm going to go ahead and ask Senator Brown's question. Senator Hayden, how did you get to $12,870,432?
No rounding.
I anticipated that.
Or thereabouts.
You probably asked that question. I think it is rooted in, and I'll allow my testifier to get to the precise question, but it is rooted in trying to catch up for the cuts that were made over the last 10 or 12 years. I think it is, and as you can see, we rank 44th in spending for this, so we're trying to kind of restore what has been taken away so that we can continue this good work. But I think my testifier can.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that is the amount to restore the 29% that was lost in 2003.
Thank you for that. And I should note, I believe this is the governor does have some restoration of this in his budget. I believe it's $1 million a year.
Yes.
Directed to greater Minnesota counties.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah. Senator Brown, you had a question?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for asking my first question. and I would attempt your name, but I'll butcher it, so I won't. But also, it sounds like this is simply restoring funding that you've had in the past. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, have you had any increases in funding since 2003?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, to the local public health grant, no. There has not been any increase since 2003.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what is the current base for local public health grants? I'm just trying to get an order of magnitude.
Mr. Chair, it is currently at $20 million. This would bring it per year, and this would bring it up to $26 million per year.
Mr. Chair.
No. Sure. This is $12 million a year additional appropriation. Was that supposed to be a biennial appropriation?
Mr. Chair, we may need to clarify that for you. I thought it was 20 and 6, but it seems like it would be 31 to 40 million.
That's not quite adding up either, but is MDH here maybe? Could
Mr. Chair, Senators, the base amount...
Please state your name for the
sorry.
Record.
No, I'm Deborah fine. Burns. I'm the Director of the Health Partnership Division at the Minnesota Department of Health. The base amount for the local public health grant is $20.7 million per year. I believe the proposal for would be that was submitted... would be a 6% or a 6-point-something million-dollar increase per year. So it sounds like the 12 was for the biennium.
The bill in front of us has $12,870,432 per year added to the base. I think that's where we're getting confused here.
I can't speak to that. I can just speak to what the base is. Thank
okay.
You.
Well, Mr. Chair, it looks like we have a little bit of a numbers issue
savings.
Here. A little bit of a savings. So this could actually save some money, but I'm not sure that we have the number in front of us. It does appear if we listen to our testifiers that maybe what we need to do is to cut this in half to get us to where we were trying to go. In other words, $12 million per or this number biennium versus. It being per year, because then that would make it $24 million in the biennium, and I think that that clearly is not the direction we were trying to get to. So I do apologize to the committee for that.
Okay. Should we make a motion to reduce each of those numbers by
yeah,
half?
I'd love to make that motion, Mr. Chair. Can I move that we strike line 1.5, maybe... Someone could give me some help on the precise math, but
Mr. Chair, can we just
Senator
go?
Benson?
Can we just go 6 million? And this is going to be laid over for possible inclusion. I think 6 million is probably close.
Yeah, that would make the most sense.
Six. So Senator Hayden moves that on line 1.5 strike both occurrences of $12,870,432 and replace with $6 million. On that motion, any questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Senator Benson, a follow-up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow-up to Senator Hayden's. We rank 44th in the nation. I would love to see that study and do an apples-to-apples because we have a lot of outreach grants and things that other states might put in their public health grants. And so... I'd like to see that study and get a better idea of where we actually fit if you have the opportunity.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Benson, I'd
Senator
love
Hay.
To work with you on that, bring the folks over so you can kind of get those questions answered. We can probably figure out how they got arrived at that number.
Thank you.
Any other questions of members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 797? Seeing none, Senator Hayden moves Senate File 797 as amended be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Good. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. And that completes our business for the day. We stand adjourned. Thank you, members.